Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
What we've got to do is recognize our time isn't yet, and we're on the doorstep of our time, and we have to get there. And so what I would say to those young people is, don't screw up your future playing in the present while the present is unraveling. Better to forego it, take a few years. You're not going to get there necessarily. Maybe this whole thing blows up before you ever get there, in which case, I'm sorry, but your best bet is not to play in the present.
This week, we're very excited to welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Eric Weinstein. You guys all know Eric Weinstein. We'll keep the introduction short and sweet. As we promised you last week and in our Realignment Substack, we've been thinking a lot about how to grapple with the recent Capitol chaos and the riots that we saw on Capitol Hill. How can we bring this country together in light of these calls for impeachment, in light of Trump getting banned from Twitter, in light of every terrible thing, an officer dying? You see it everywhere, and it seems that things are just coming at you constantly, and that it's about division, division, division. And Eric is one of those people truly in his heart who wants to bring this country together, is thinking about how can we actually do that. He pulls no punches in this interview for our leadership class, for everybody in Washington that got us to where we are today, to the media. And it was just really cathartic personally having this conversation with him amidst all of the chaos that we have in our society right now.
Yeah. And the best part about Eric is he's able to offer a really, really, really incisive critique of the system in our leadership class, while at the same time, not just promoting nihilism, which is the worst thing. It's nothing is worse than people who come in, attack everything, attack everyone, and then retreat into their Patreon subscription where they just feed people more of the same stuff. Eric is here trying to give people a useful framework for looking at the world, especially during the really harrowing political moment we live in right now. Sagar and I disagree with him plenty, but once again, it's the perspective that he's bringing that we think is most valuable.
As I mentioned, we now have a weekly newsletter that hits your inbox on Friday, therealignment.substack.com. Guys, make sure to check it out. We've got transcripts. We feature long listener emails, links to books, anything that we're really interested in that's related to an episode on the show. We've been getting some amazing feedback on it, and I just want to see more of you participate so that we can get a direct line of communication. Again, it's therealignment.substack.com.
Link is included below in the show notes, along with the link to the Realignment Bookshop. Bookshop is a great platform. It allows us to support local booksellers. Well, also, if you purchase on Bookshop, you actually give the show a nice commission. It's great to support our work. We have three different lists. One list is the books that we're reading this year. Another is the list of books by our guests. And the final list was our best reads of 2020. We have Sagar's list and we have my list. A bunch of you all have already purchased books already. That's really exciting. It's generally really cool if you get a kick out of reading random books like American Buffalo and .com. There's a lot of great stuff there, so be sure to check it out. Like I said, link is in the show notes below.
And I don't want to admonish you guys too hard. I did promise that we would stop begging you for 5-star ratings on Apple Podcasts. But we haven't had a lot of ratings recently, Marshall. And I got to tell you, I'm kind of addicted. I'm hooked on it. So if you could help us out, leave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, especially a written review. It would dramatically help the show. And more importantly, in that written review, you get to ask us a question. So leave us a written question in your 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If not, no worries. Take a screenshot of your 5-star review, send it into realignmentpod@gmail.com with the question. We will answer anything that you ask. What is the question this week, Marshall?
Like Sagar said, we are not demanding something and offering nothing. Here is this week's question, which comes from Apple Podcasts. It is from 2Down. Can someone please make a case for wanting anything to get done in D.C.? It just seems like the things that are easiest to do aren't good for most anyone, and the hardest stuff never gets out of the gates. Please convince me why I'd be better off not just rooting for continued gridlock.
It's a really interesting question. Here's what I would say, 2Down, which is that we already live in a system of gridlock. One of the things that people lie to you about is the idea that nothing gets done during gridlock. Actually, a lot gets done. It's the stuff that you guys all probably hate. It's the things that there's a general bipartisan consensus on here in Washington. So actually, what you should be rooting for is not gridlock, but is a leadership which is unified in government that actually wants to affirmatively get something done. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that that is going to be the best case under Joe Biden, but here is the truth, and we're very honest with you here. $2,000 checks are probably more likely because Democrats took control of the Senate, and I do think that that matters, and that would not have happened if there was normal Washington gridlock. I'm not rooting for the Dems or anything. I'm just telling you what that does look like and what gridlock in principle actually means.
During the break, Sagar and I spoke a lot about what the listener profile of someone who looks at the show. We have some populists, we have Bernie people, we have Trumpy people, we have neoliberals, we have the whole entire gamut of the ideological spectrum. The one thing that unifies basically our entire listenership, though, is the idea that we do not like the status quo in this country and in many ways, the status quo in the world. So if you don't like the status quo, the number one thing you should not be rooting for is gridlock. If you don't like the status quo when it comes to student loans or the hospital system or the fact that we can't build protective equipment in the country, all of these questions are ones that are not going to be resolved if gridlock is in effect. So what you should do, two down, is separate your critique of big things that get done. You're probably referring to, and for example, Eric mentions this during the episode, you're referring to the fact that the Senate, on a bipartisan basis, voted to prevent student loans from getting discharged in 2005. You're maybe referring to a Wall Street bailout that you didn't like. It's totally fair to critique those things, and you should critique them. But don't confuse your distaste for bipartisan agreement for the idea that gridlock in of itself is good.
Well said, Marshall. As always, a special shout out to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. Really appreciate all that they let us do here. And with that, let's dive into the show. Dr. Eric Weinstein, welcome back to The Realignment.
Careful with the doctor. I don't want to be confused with somebody preparing to do surgery.
That's true.
See you both.
That's also a pun, Eric. My parents are both PhD doctors themselves. So ever since the whole scandal on Jill Biden, I've been calling them both doctor. So I just think that it's an honorific that we should try
actually
to give everybody.
I'll be entirely honest. I really don't think MDs should be called doctor. If anyone should be called doctor, it should be PhDs, but I figure we should let it slide.
See, we're already got such good content. Eric, we wanted to bring you back to the show because you've been putting out some really just, I think, profound thoughts about where we are at the state of the country. I think you recently tweeted you're having trouble sleeping as a result of the Capitol riots and so much of what we saw. And I just want to give you the opportunity to just give us your thoughts and break down this terrible week in America and how you think that we can get out of this. What can we do?
Well, I want to even go... I think it is a terrible week, but I don't think it's a terrible week for the same reasons that everyone else seems to think it's a terrible week. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's going on is that we have a very strange selective memory, and the selective memory doesn't remember the fact that we've had bombings in the Capitol building. We've had a Jewish suicide bomber in the Capitol building in previous times.
Puerto Rican occupiers. He even goes deeper than that.
Yeah. Right. So the fact is that the optics of this week are absolutely horrendous. We had a police law enforcement officer beaten to death with a fire extinguisher, which, you know, I really don't even have words for that. But I also think that in part, we're not really capable of having the discussion about what really happened. Let's start with the Viking. Mm-hmm. Right, we had a Viking taking pictures, playing around, I don't know, in the Senate or the House. And I think that this really gets to the heart of what's going on, which is that we are LARPing our way into Armageddon. And the seriousness of this, you know, all of the talk of civil war and all this kind of stuff, is weirdly not getting our opportunity to find the off-ramp. In large measure, what we've got is two teams of live action role players, or so-called LARPers, and they're engaging in something that I was worried about in, I think, 2013, and I wrote an article for the Edge Annual Question, and they asked, what is the scientific theory that everyone should have in their cognitive toolkit? And I had several ideas. I was going to write about regulated expression in genetics. And I said to my wife, you know, the thing I really want to write about is kayfabe. And that is the system of lies and deceptions found inside of professional wrestling. Now, of course, that's not going to be seen as an academic theory. But professional wrestling and the intelligence community are the two places that understand nested levels of deception better than any other two groups. And they're light years ahead of psychology departments. So part of what's going on is that we've got two national LARPing complexes that are engaged in what I would call kayfabe. So we have Vikings, people are posing, stealing the lectern, I don't know, from the House of Representatives, thinking that they're at some kind of a rave or a party. Maybe it's Burning Man for politics, not clear. That situation can go completely insane and become real in a way that I don't think people appreciate. So I often pose the question, which is more real, mixed martial arts or professional wrestling? And I would say professional wrestling by a long shot. If you look at the list of deaths associated with professional wrestling, it doesn't get more real than that. I don't think UFC has had its first fatality yet. And in essence, what we have is we have a mock national conversation, one around Stop the Steal, which has rejected the United States justice system, which has refused to give Donald Trump much comfort. And the idea that you're going to save America from its own justice system is pretty interesting by going around the will of the courts. So I think what we have here is we have a national meaning crisis where there are people who have very little future and there are people who still have a future. And the people who still have a future are selling LARPing to two teams, you know, one of which is Wokistan and the other of which is Magistan. And so we now have a war mostly on the internet, mostly through kayfabe, of Magistan versus Wokistan, which have to be two of the, you know, most intellectually crippled theories you could have, not because they don't contain seeds of truth, but because they fill in what is missing with total nonsense. And I think that what's going on, did you guys take a look at the video of the woman being shot in the Capitol?
Yes, yeah. We did.
How closely did you study it?
I think I saw it three or four different angles, but I saw this woman literally leap towards a gun and I just couldn't stop thinking. I'm like, what really compels somebody to do that? I mean, it's pure and genuine belief.
Well, and that's exactly it. This is like the Boxer Rebellion in China, where you had people who were convinced that they had supernatural powers, or, you know, you get kids, on some powerful drug and you turn them into child warriors and you make them wear dresses and you tell them that the dress will make them invincible, or, you know, I forget what the general, you know, butt naked or whatever it was in Africa. There's sort of supernatural beliefs about what's going on. And one of the angles on the woman being killed shows the gun emerge first, pointed at the window that they're trying to break through.
Right.
And you clearly hear on the audio, he's got a gun, right? So it's clear warning. You see that the finger that is to pull the trigger is properly not on the trigger. It's not inside the trigger guard. It's along the barrel of the pistol. It comes inside the trigger guard and then it goes back out. This is not somebody who is looking to discharge a weapon. This is somebody looking to not discharge a weapon. And the idea that this woman was climbing up on this right into a gun is bolstered by the idea that right behind her, immediately after she's shot, you see all sorts of law enforcement officers armed to the effing teeth who are clearly behind her, who are not stopping this thing. We are not going to have an accurate discussion. What we're going to have is a political football. And the political football is going to be used by anyone and everyone who has a partisan axe to grind in an attempt to divide the country into these warring factions. And we can't get at these two insane mimetic complexes because the center is actually sponsoring the lunatics. So figure that the center of the left and the right, the establishment, is busy looting the United States government, stealing as much silver as it can, cutting the paintings out of the frames. And they're distracting the people with no future as the people who still have a stake in the game and can hollow us out, keep amping us up. And I posted something on social media. If you recall, Donald Trump was encouraging people to rough up the protesters and beat them up back in the 2016 election. Mm-hmm. And one guy who was 78 threw an elbow into the eye of an African-American and sort of sucker punched him with an elbow. And I went looking for those two guys, thinking I should get them on my podcast. And I found that they'd reconciled and they hugged in a courtroom and they put this behind them. And in 4 years, the video had fewer than 20,000 views and fewer than, I think, 20 likes. And I posted this, and immediately just posting it caused it a 50% increase in the viewership over 4 years in a single day. We are being kept from coming together. We are being kept from getting rid of these people. And right now, the most important thing is that by any, and with apologies to Malcolm X, by any legal means necessary, we have got to remove our current leadership, period, the end, there is no more.
So a question that comes to mind, because it came up a couple of times during your statement there, LARPing. There's a portion of the audience which isn't online. If you're not on Twitter, this won't make as much sense for you. So can you just describe the phenomenon of LARPing? What is it and how does it manifest itself on the Wokistani side or the Magistani side, if you will?
Well, okay, sure. If you ever go to, let's say if you go to Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, many of the most nerdy and kind of spectrum-y kids are engaged. And by the way, I say that with zero disrespect. I'm proud to be part of that group. Engage in sort of live action versions of Dungeons and Dragons. And they've got foam swords and maces and all sorts of things. And they're, you know, very clear rules. And you get to play in a fantasy medieval war situation, let's say. Now, in some sense, it's like the Stanford Prison Experiment of Zimbardo, where you tell people, your guards, your prisoners. And sure enough, theater becomes real. There's a limited ability to suspend the distance between our characters and ourselves. Our characters are in some sense real. And what's interesting is that live action role-playing can become immersive. You can forget that you're in a game. And in kayfabe, which is sort of professional wrestling system of deceptions, you break things into work or shoot. A work is a scripted activity in taking place. By the way, kayfabe is carnival speak for fake. And so a work would be as if, we agreed to have a fight on this podcast to drive your ratings through the roof, right? Coming up in 10 minutes. And
I have some words for you, doctor. Yes.
Marshall, I've had about enough of your back talk.
Yeah.
Let's not call out CNN too hard here.
So then a shoot would be the spontaneous occurrence of reality in a scripted event. And then tertiary deception occurs where you think you have a work where everyone's in on it. By the way, if you don't understand that professional wrestling is fake, you're called a mark. If you understand that it's fake, you're called a smart mark or a smark. And one of the reasons I love this stuff is that I can't get the language that the espionage community uses to talk about deception, you know, like false flags and stuff like that. Right. They're very advanced, but professional wrestling by now is known to all. So the smarks understand that it's all fake, but then you can have a situation where the fourth wall appears to break and the people who are in on the idea that it's a deception are suddenly freaked out to find out that it's spilled over into reality. But that spillover into reality can in fact be encased by another fourth wall. And that would be called a worked shoot. So what's going on right now is that we don't have language for the levels of theater, deception, fantasy, and we're struggling. So what we do is we keep finding meaning. And if you'll notice very carefully, what we're doing this week is that we're finding weekend meaning, you know, these are the darkest days of America. We thought it could never happen here. But in shocking footage released from Capitol Hill, we see the destruction of everything good about this country, blah, blah, blah. That kind of mock seriousness is preposterous. I mean, this has been visible for the entire time that we've been engaged in this. And nobody cares about the fact that we are a thermonuclear nation, trifling with the very dangerous business of degrading the customs of the United States, which are used to evade the need for putting restrictions into law. Our culture has allowed us to be free. And right now what you're seeing is the degradation of our culture, which will necessitate rules, right? The old magic of America is it's the country in which you have no desire to burn the flag you have every right to burn. And when you lose that culture, you're going to see a call to restrict free action. So the magic of the United States is not its constitution. I've compared that to the written Torah of the United States. But the written Torah is complemented in a duality by the oral Torah. And the written Torah doesn't really work on its own. You need the oral Torah and the culture to animate the document. The document can't do anything. What we're now seeing is a complete degradation. The great attack of Donald Trump was on the oral Torah and culture of the United States. And a lot of people who found that very restrictive, it's like, why can't I tell Pollock jokes? When was the last time anybody told a Pollock joke? I grew up and there were books of Pollock jokes. We don't do that anymore. And that kind of behavior is something that we can do. We just choose not to. So we're talking now about the degradation of our culture, where Donald Trump has pioneered the idea that if everyone is thrown out the first baseball, every president is thrown out the first baseball of the season, he realizes that there's a huge win to be gotten by not going along with tradition. Every time there's a tradition or a custom, you can always just decide that you're going to disobey it to show how independent, you know, the fact, let's imagine it had been going on for 200 years, which it hasn't.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. I'm the first person in 200 years to think for myself. And that's what Donald Trump has been doing. He's been degrading the oral Torah of the United States, which was holding things together so we didn't need rules. And the people who didn't like the oral Torah and wanted to be completely free to be, you know, their horrible selves, were super enthusiastic about the idea that Donald Trump was finally freeing us. And guess what's going to happen next? You're going to see a move to shut down speech on the internet. You're going to have the major tech platforms refusing to host. You're going to have financial harassment. I've been making the joke for years that should Republicans be allowed to use the streets? That's not a joke. I start seeing calls that Republicans shouldn't be able to buy groceries. So I think that the problem is, I think this is a grave week. As Marshall says, I've been up, you know, I really am on no sleep. But I don't think it's serious for the same reasons. I think that the problem is that this LARPing can become reality. It can convert to reality. It's a rehearsal for something. And effectively, it's like if you're waving a gun around with no intention of firing and it suddenly goes off, you've just transitioned into a different world. And you see this all the time. And right now what people are doing is that they're dancing on the eaves of a building, you know, and somebody's going to fall sooner or later. And the whole thing is going to convert in seconds.
How does the leadership class distinguish between the LARPing and the actual danger moments? Because, and I think we've mentioned this, I'm from Portland, Oregon, and you see the example of this in the treatment of Antifa. Back in July, back in June, Mayor Ted Wheeler, the leadership class of the city, say that it doesn't exist, it's not real. Anything that does exist is basically referred to as LARPing. Come November, predictably, as soon as Donald Trump is no longer in the presidency, the mayor of Portland gives a very strong, very aggressive statement about Antifa not following the law, all these sorts of things. So that's the center-left to left-wing version. The right-wing version is...
The center-left to left-wing version. That's something that's never... Ted Wheeler is an abomination unlike anything that we've ever seen on the center left. I don't know what that is.
My point is that here's what I more mean by that. I suspect that most mayors of most Democratic cities would have operated in the sense that Ted Wheeler operated. What I want to do is bring this back to what happened last week. If you went to most Republicans who have now turned very aggressively against what happened at the Capitol, they would probably say, there's protesters. It basically doesn't matter. There's going to be some MAGA people. There's going to be a couple groypers, whatever. It doesn't really matter. Now it matters. So from my perspective, on both sides of the aisle, you see a leadership class that doesn't seem able to navigate the LARP to real world danger scenario. How, from your perspective, should they think about that?
I don't think we have a leadership class. And Marshall, I don't mean to say that I can't understand your question. I mean to say that we should reject your question. The frame is the problem. Let me make a more provocative statement and then attempt to back it up, because the provocative statement is going to obviously sound insane. I don't think the United States government really exists at the moment. I don't think that there is a leadership class. I think what happens is that, you know, just the way you have an army during peacetime, which develops certain habits, you get peacetime generals, people play war games. It's not really an army. And then you have a live action situation, and the thing has to convert into a fighting force. I think we don't have a government, and I don't think we've had a government for a long time. I think in some sense, the last time the United States clearly existed may have been 1945, and then it has been degrading in various fashions from that. So that was a pretty functional thing we put together during World War II. And, you know, we were able to do the space program, and, you know, the 1950s were an era of incredible scientific progress, and unfortunately also incredible military progress with both us and the Iron Curtain, behind the Iron Curtain. But I don't think that you understand how little the government actually exists now. And when Donald Trump got elected, I went to visit a colleague at the old Eisenhower office building off the West Wing. And as I was walking the halls, I noticed how many offices were empty. They seemed to have very important plaques on their doors.
Yeah.
There was no Trump intellectual movement that you could staff the government with. And I think this goes back to something that Sagar and Crystal said beautifully on Joe Rogan right at the beginning. I recommend everybody to the beginning of that episode. That there are these two teams that get rotated in and out of government. And either you go into the think tanks or you go into the office buildings the government office buildings. Trump did not have an intellectual movement to put in. And so as a result, you know, it's sort of the dream of the anti-tax movement that you want a government so small you can strangle it in a bathtub. And I think that in part, he wasn't able to staff because Donald Trump really was the only thing behind Trumpism. It was a completely idiosyncratic drunken boxing movement where Donald Trump understands a few things very well, better than anyone else, and many things much worse than anyone else, or he's just a horrible human being. But he's at his best when he's sticking it to the left, the institutional organized left, which again isn't really left at all, based on its hypocrisy. He's very effective at that. He's the only, if you include military and administrative appointments, I don't think we have had another president with zero government experience. And that's an incredible achievement. And many people said, we're never going to get another shot. Let's get on this train, even though we can see the danger, even though we despise him, because the main thing is to stop the insiders from selling us out to China, from selling us out to Davos. The major business post the fall of the Berlin Wall has been selling out those Americans too weak to defend themselves in order to get wealth by globalization, let's say, or financialization or anything like that. So we've been in a suicidal spiral clearly since Bill Clinton and arguably before that. In such a situation, I don't think we have a leadership class. And I think that the people who are sitting in those seats are children. And they're children who are, in general, at the national level, many of them are born in the 1940s. I mean, somebody pointed out that Well, the one way of saying it is Dianne Feinstein was conceived in the Hoover administration. Most of these people were conceived in, like, you know, the Truman administration. This is not a way to lead a technologically advanced society into the 21st century. These people can't code. They've never used a pipette. They don't know what the Teller-Ulam design is. They're not technically capable people. They're professional peacetime kleptocrats. And the extent to which Ted Wheeler and Mayor Jenny destroyed confidence in the willingness to enforce the law created this thing that I got really attacked on social media for, which is that we created the never Trump Trump voter, people who hate Donald Trump with a passion, who voted for him in desperation to stop Mayor Ted Wheeler and Mayor Jenny and their obvious attempt to allow a criminal element into the city for the purposes of provocation, allowing, in particular in Portland, attacking the federal courthouse with, you guys remember the Shaggy song, "It Wasn't Me"?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That was the strategy. What Antifa?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no Antifa, it doesn't exist. And, you know, Jerry Nadler was asked about this directly, and I posted this clip where, you know, you see the courthouse being firebombed, and the claim is that the group doing the firebomb doesn't even exist. It's a myth. And, okay, this is why, for example, Black Americans believe in chemtrails, because the Tuskegee medical experiment lets them know, hey, we'd do anything. We're so crazy. Given what we've already done to you, you have no reason to believe that chemtrails aren't real. It's what we would call Bayesian priors. You're tutoring people's Bayesian priors that you're completely full of shit. You have absolutely no integrity. You're willing to engage in madness. And keep in mind that the one thing we know about LARPing is that the body count in Portland is so low because this is an agreed upon theatrical battle.
Quick thing, Eric, I have to ask you this. I'm not asking you this in the woke sense, so let me finish the thought here. I'm from Oregon, as I said before, so I only mostly know white people. So everyone I knew growing up who believed in chemtrails was white. So I get your point about why Black people. Why do white people believe in chemtrails?
Oh, that's a little bit different. The Pacific Northwest, because of its history of labor activism and communism, in part shares a lot of the history of Black America. So One of the reasons that people see me as conspiratorial is because I come from a progressive family. And so when the government has spied on your family, when it's, you know, we locked Paul Robeson in the country by taking his passport. We locked Charlie Chaplin out of the country so that he left and we wouldn't let him back in to go to his house. Once you've been the target of the United States government, you realize that the mainstream belief of, oh, that's all science fiction and you go to too many movies is complete nonsense. Mm-hmm. So I would say everybody who shares the history of being, of just being lied to and having their history completely denied. Remember, the Weather Underground was a response to the assassination of Fred Hampton at the hands of the Cook County Sheriff's Department as directed by the Federal Bureau of Investigation for the crime of introducing the Rainbow Coalition to decrease Black fighting between gangs to create a political movement. We are that crazy. And because we are that crazy, everyone who's plugged into the Howard Zinn version of our history is not quite so sure that all elections are free and fair. You know, if you take Operation Ajax in Iran, we clearly know how to turn over a government.
That was the overthrow of the Shah, right?
Yeah. Mossadegh.
Right. So yeah.
Too many operations. It's hard to keep track.
Operation Condor in Chile. I mean, the issue is, if you don't know your history, maybe all this sounds like conspiracy theory. If you do know your history, you know what we're capable of. And there's no question that we're capable of throwing an election. And then now the problem is, okay, he said that. It's a little bit like saying, I don't believe vaccines are 100% safe. Now, that's clearly true. Vaccines are not 100% safe. However, there's an expectation that nobody will speak reality if you're part of, you know, if you're like me and you have advanced degrees in something, you're supposed to deny reality the way everybody denies reality. We're now at the point where the public, so many members of the public have caught on to the fact that the national official narrative is total nonsense. And they're willing to believe anything at this point.
This is something I really want to focus in on with you, Eric. And I want to kind of turn it into where we are today. And something I've talked a lot about on Rising and talking about tomorrow is about impeachment. And a point that I've been trying to make, and I'm curious to get both your guys' thoughts on this, is that in the context of impeachment, the way I look at as impeachment is you have to have, this is essentially the most extreme act that you can go through as a democratic society, invalidating the election, the previous, removing the democratically elected president of the United States. And I looked at the recent polling, to the extent that we even have polling, and I don't know if I even believe it, but what we have is this. 56% of polls, 56% of Americans say that Trump should go. And you could say that's a lot, but to me, I'm like, wait, so there's still a sizable majority of the country that says that he shouldn't go. And then you look within Republicans and you say 73% or whatever still approve of Trump, still, you know, think of the job he's doing. Some have even, you know, justify the Capitol violence. And I'm not saying any of this with a qualitative judgment. What I'm saying is if your goal is to unite the country, if your goal is to move on, which is what Joe Biden and many of the case for him was, this seems to me the worst possible thing that you could do. But then the other side, to impeach Trump either right now or to impeach and, you know, bar him from office in the future. Because the way I look at it is that would be one of the single biggest instances of trying to basically not even invalidate votes, but to tell a sizable minority of this country, 44% or so, that the person that you have immense faith in is no longer allowed to represent you as president. And it seems to me that it could be, I'm not saying it's intentional, that it's a cover for not wanting to address the reasons that Trump was elected in the first place, number one. And this is what I said today too, is look, if you're Joe Biden or the Democrats and you want to make sure that Trump is never elected again, you don't have to impeach him. Do, you know, distribute a vaccine properly and like pass $2,000 checks for all Americans. You will win the presidency. It's actually not that hard. I want to get your thoughts on impeachment about the legitimacy of democracy. No, it's fine. If you disagree, it's fine. Because my goal, what I know is that you're trying to operate in good faith towards trying to be a more harmonious country. Yeah. And it seems to me that a lot of this, a lot of impeachment talk and more, is about punishment. It's about penalizing. And I have to try and take Trump out of it because I find what he did so odious and all of that. But we still have to live with many of the people who voted for him in this country. And we have to channel those concerns and more. Go ahead.
We don't have to live with them. They're us.
Yes,
those are my
exactly.
brothers. Right. Those are my brothers and sisters. And let me tell you something. You guys have kids?
No,
we don't.
Okay. Let me imagine you're my kids. Okay. You get involved in a cult. You think I'm not coming back? I'm coming in for you to get you the hell out of there. You think that I'm not, that I'm just going to, you know, dismiss you and say, oh my God, they're now part of a cult and they're beyond the pale. And I have to cut ties and I'm going to disavow them.
Yeah, of course.
Fuck that shit. Mm-hmm. Okay. MAGA is our responsibility. Those are my brothers and sisters. I'm not running away from them. I'm not interested in that. I'm not demonizing them. But a cult, it is. I'm not going to say it isn't a cult. I'm also not going to say that woke isn't a cult. It's a cult. Mm-hmm. These cults are incredibly powerful. And some of us have been noticing that there is no class of break glass in case of emergency people in our country. This is sometimes what a monarchy is supposed to do. I was hanging out with a royal family in Europe, which will remain nameless. And
there's like three, so someone can figure this out.
No, there's more than that. There's more than that. Yeah.
And a prince was saying, well, you have to appreciate we're in a very bad situation. There's no justification for monarchy anymore. So we're really sort of hanging on by a thread. And I said, look, I'm anti-monarchy, but you should at least be able to steel man the case. He says, well, what do we do? What is our function? And I said, you've had 75 years of peace since the end of World War II. How often do you use a fire extinguisher? Almost never. Does that mean that you just get rid of the fire extinguisher because you haven't used it? No, you check in on it. And when you need it, it's there. And what's the purpose? You're supposed to walk the rubble when the bombs are falling, you know, on a city, for example. You're supposed to give the people something to rally around. And I don't believe in doing that through monarchy because I'm an American. We reject that. But I do believe in Buzz Aldrin, right? I do believe that there are people who are apart, you know? Like when Killer Mike spoke in Atlanta, he seemed to be apart. I don't know who that guy is. I'm not really a hip hop fan, but I was really impressed with him. And if you, you know, in particular, I am a huge fan of Black oratory. The skill involved in Black oratory coming out of the Black church is its own thing. And it's one of the things I'm proudest of as an American. There are times when you have to address a mob or a crowd. There are times you have to do what James Brown did after Martin Luther King. I'm going to get through this. We have got a situation in which we don't believe in seating anybody who has those characteristics in the chairs. The reason that I want to do Rising more than I want to talk to the two of you is not anything against Marshall. It's about the optics. Mm-hmm. Rising looks like adulthood. It looks like it comes from the institutional complex. And the optics is the adults. The institutions don't listen to anyone outside of a closed system. And effectively, they've put up this barrier where they call everything alt-right or far-right that doesn't have the right characteristics, which is on the take. And right now, the important thing is to seat the people who have tried to call both balls and strikes for 4 years and have been torn apart, who've had their families torn apart, who've, you know, look, I work for a guy who supported Donald Trump in 2016, was noticeably absent in 2020. My entire ability to speak freely comes from my good friend's money. And the fact that I disagree with him and I love him so much that I trust that he will not sever me because I'm undermining his political. I mean, this, you know, my brother, for example, is ejected from Evergreen State College because he was willing to stand against racism, even if it comes from blacks.
Yeah.
You know, the number of people who've tried to call balls and strikes for 4 years is tiny. And right now, what I want to do is I want to take Brian Williams and Mara Gay, and I want to give them a huge vacation. Let them go to Tulum. And I want to seat different people in those chairs. If those people can't figure out even how to add and subtract, speaking of their crazy idea that Bloomberg could have given everyone $1 million with his campaign investment, there is no commentary class that's competent that sits in those chairs. It's, you know, the problem, as I've said, is that the system isn't broken, it's fixed. And until you actually seat your critics, until you do what we used to do, which is to seat the Noam Chomskys at a place like MIT, so that the conscience of MIT lives inside of MIT, so that the ombudsman can say that the paper is out of control at the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. When you don't seat your critics inside of the organization, you are on the road to self-extinguishing. And right now, the most important thing is to realize that we don't have time to put everything on the blockchain to build new institutions. Important thing right now is to get the tiny number of people who've been calling balls and strikes, who were born after 1964, into those effing chairs to tell the system, you're over, it's over, you're done. You people from the 40s, you're failed. You don't understand where you are. You're not technically competent. You don't have the country's best interests at heart. You've sold us to China. You've created incredibly deep fake stories about you know, the intelligence complex taking over the world, or you know, something about the desire to destroy America. All of these crazy stories that we've built around Wokistan and Magistan have to go. And they are responsive to each other. woke creates MAGA, MAGA creates woke. You know, it's the snake is eating its own tail. The whole way we get out of this is that we put the people we trust more. Let me give you a very simple rubric. Take anyone where the official description of that person is maximally divergent from the actual description of that person. Like Ben Shapiro is a Nazi. Okay, an Orthodox Jewish Nazi. That's pretty interesting. You know, Sam Harris is an incredible Islamophobe. No, he isn't. I know Sam. He's my good friend. All of these things. Brett Weinstein is, you know, the far right. Seat the people where the description of them inside the gated institutional narrative or the gin is maximally divergent from the reality, because that's the place that the system showed you. Let the system tell you who it fears, and seat the people in the chairs who are feared most, who are maximally misportrayed. And then you'll have a solution.
But here's the question, Eric, which is that, and for the record, Eric is coming on Rising, so don't everybody worry about that. He will be there and it's going to be great. But here's the problem. Democrats and Democratic primary voters in particular, who select our possible next president, they love Brian Williams and Mara Gay, and they love MSNBC and the MSNBC lineup and Republican, but they do. They trust them. Don't. If you serve the same... I don't know.
So because, let's specify.
Yeah, go ahead.
A certain very influential and powerful part of the Democratic Party, people who live in Northern Virginia, people who live in the Long Island suburbs, the Park Avenue reference and everything, they certainly do like those
people. Long Island suburbs? The Hamptons?
We're reaching the limits of my East Coastness.
Of our conventional wisdom. I want to make just one second. I want to make this point too. Because the Republican Party does deeply trust Fox as well. And so to the point of the media actors who, I would love nothing more than to be seated. But I can tell you, I go on Fox. There is a character that they want me to play. Increasingly, I have been doing a lot less because they will ask me to come on. And all they want me to do is smack the left, smack the left, smack the left, or talk about culture war issues. And I'm like, no, because this is ripping this country in half. And I've increasingly turned down a lot of appearances unless it's to talk about an economic system.
You know what my condition is for going on Fox?
Go ahead.
I've done this. Like the last time, I think it was probably Greg Gutfeld. I said, if I come on Fox, I'm telling your audience that I view Fox as a propaganda network. And he says, sure. I said, we got
that's great. Yeah, that's good.
No, but I'm telling you, this is part of the deal, which is what's going on is not quite correct. So let's take Long Island. The Hamptons loves Kamala Harris.
Yeah.
The Kamala Harris that is loved in the Hamptons is not the Kamala Harris that we see. In other words, it's like a developer looking at a computer program. They see the code. We see the binary. We see the finished product without being able to see what's actually going on. They specifically love Kamala Harris because they know who she is and what she's going to do for them. And we see the front end, which is what she's going to do to us. So first of all, no, I don't think that they love Brian Williams. And if you think that they love Brian Williams, please allow me to go on opposite Brian Williams and Mara Gay. They're going to love him a lot less because, you know, it's a little bit like thinking that the professional wrestlers, it's like the Gracie Challenge. We used to talk about karate and kung fu and all of these things. And Brazilian jiu-jitsu wasn't on anybody's list of coolest martial arts back in the 1970s, right? It's only when you actually start pitting these things against each other that you stop believing that somebody is the coolest or the best, you know?
Right.
I mean, like Steve Vai seems to be the greatest guitarist in the world until somebody named Guthrie Govan shows up and then like, check out what happens there. At some level, they live in a protected world. And in professional wrestling, it would be called a promotion. They're not actually fighting. Brian Williams is scripted to win. He's a designated winner. So we have a designated winner system and we can't get away from them. But are you telling me that people weren't getting frustrated about what was done to Tulsi Gabbard? When Tulsi went after-
There's like two people, Eric, Rick, there's like two people who actually feel like, I want to tell a quick story about this because it reflects, I think, a danger in over-valorizing Rising, No offense, Sagar.
No, it's fine.
When I was doing rising panels back in January and February, every week we were doing the polls, everything like that. I thought Andrew Yang and Tulsi were just crushing it because you'd say something nice about Andrew and I would get all these really nice comments that talked about how smooth my skin looked. Or I would say something about Tulsi and her foreign policy. People would say, this young guy is the smartest young guy you've ever seen. But then the actual election happens and they get like 4% and 2% and 3% of the vote.
That's not my point.
Well, but my point though is that if we're talking about, like, here's a better way to put this. Brian Williams represents far bigger of a constituency, at least for right now, at least for the subsequent future, than anything Tulsi Gabbard's putting up there. Tulsi Gabbard, bless her. I'm not using that in the Texas sense. It's not an insult, but Tulsi Gabbard she's this weird former Republican who's conservative in many socially conservative ways. She's progressive in different ways, but that's not an actual viewpoint which has a serious constituency. So I just can't accept the idea that she and a person who represents her ideology is the inverse of Brian Williams. No, that's my concern.
Let me be very clear about this. I don't think necessarily that Andrew or Tulsi would have won. I'm not claiming that they were set to win. What I am claiming is that when you starve people for airtime, and when you publish like the ugliest picture of them and the most attractive picture of somebody else, you do all the media tricks that we do every time, and you drop people from your graphics, that has the effect of letting somebody know that person isn't going to win. And we tend to take the message. We know that, I knew that Andrew and Tulsi weren't going to do very well. That causes me not to want to invest in them. And so I never signed on to Andrew or to Tulsi. What I am trying to say is that many of us face this accumulated thumb pressure on the scales of justice. And the justice in this case has to do with the primary. There was no primary. My claim is that the primary didn't exist. It was not free and fair. It's sealed in a particular way. I don't think that the candidates are allowed to assemble unless the event is sanctioned. The events that are given are given out to legacy media structures. The time given to the candidates is wildly asymmetric. There are all sorts of ways in which the rules are built to make sure that there has to be an appearance that anyone can enter, but that will not actually happen in a way in which the general election is threatened. An insider will always prevail for the general. And that's what Donald Trump snuck through on the Republican side. Bernie almost snuck through it in 2016. And we don't really know what would have happened with Tulsi and Andrew.
Here's my question too, though, which is even within this premise, which is that within the gin, because what you're supposing is that if you were allowed to go on Brian Williams, but then we both know that they're not going to invite you. So, I mean, this is part of what I want to get at, which is that I think your concept of the gin is incredibly important to anybody who's actually trying to think about systems, because when you're thinking about systems, that's when you actually can think generally on a much more structural level as to why incentives work and the way that people respond to those incentives within them, which is that at a base level, your success, my success, you know, the reason people are even tuning into this conversation is because Brian Williams will never invite you on. They're not going to have me on MSNBC anytime soon. And it's within that closure of the system. What my greatest fear is, I used to think they have to eventually relent because they're losing market share or whatever. But it's just not true. The truth is that they got the result that they wanted in the primary. And they're more profitable than ever. They actually have more viewers than ever by doubling down on the strategy. Is there a solution to that? That's my question, because I'm not sure if there is right now.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is this is the Jayaprakash Narayan effect. If you know Indian history, during Indira Gandhi's emergency, most of the founding fathers of modern India had moved on from the independence movement and had become bureaucrats, had become wealthy by getting in on the spoils of a new nation. And there was this one guy, Jayaprakash Narayan, who was sort of the patron saint of lost causes, whose heart was too pure to actually profit from the good work that he did. And when Indira Gandhi declared the state of emergency, as she did, which was highly unpopular, the cry went out, in the darkness there is one light. Jayaprakash, you know, is the word for light, right? Prakash. And the slogan was Sampurna Kranti Abnarahai Bhavityas Hamarahai. Total revolution is now the slogan, future history is ours. And that's how this game works. You're pushing the world towards the Jayaprakash Narayan moment. He didn't matter except once. But when you need Jayaprakash Narayan, you're not going to reach for Brian Williams. You're not going to reach for Sean Hannity. You're going to want to, there are people, you know, people, I have not even set up a Patreon page, and I won't do it until after the inauguration, you know, or some people have no ability to contribute to me. And it's probably an empty gesture, but the point is, you need people who are planning only for that one eventuality.
I want to build on something here real quick, Eric, because this is interesting. It goes back to your earlier comment about leaders who are equipped. The dynamic that Sagar is speaking about with MSNBC and Rising, insert Rogan, Sam Harris, and even the Patreon economy is the idea that we no longer have big institutions. No one's getting 30 million viewers. We instead see a dissemination of audiences. So the business model for you, if you're doing a Patreon, is you get 1,000 people who love you the most to give you $10 a month, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's a lot more valuable than getting 50,000 people who are giving you YouTube revenue clicks. The problem here is that the skill set that that's selecting for is a skill set of appealing to niche audiences. If Sagar and I wanted to blow up the realignment right now, what we would do is say, we think the DNC was stolen in a sort of conspiratorial way. We would do all these little dynamics that wouldn't necessarily be honest, but they would appeal to that niche audience. So how do we have a set of leaders, or how do we create leaders, or how do we fill people into different spaces when what they haven't been selected for is integrating their group into other groups or articulating their perspective to other people and what they're doing? Yeah.
The time hasn't come. Look, I love money. Everybody says that they don't care about money. I don't know what they're talking about. I just love it because I could buy Navy SEALs to protect my house, given what I'm about to say and do. I can boost my signal. I could hire assistants. Right now, I do everything myself. My problem is that I don't love money enough. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you guys love money enough. No, I'm not kidding.
No, we don't. Yeah.
You know, but hopefully you do. You love money. It's just not enough. And your time isn't now. It becomes very clear. You know, why don't I love money? Because I have things, money is very expensive. Most of the very wealthy people I know spend almost all of their time talking about money. And I don't want that life. My time is too valuable. If time is money, my time is precious. And there's not usually enough money to buy my time. What I believe is that nobody really believes that at the moment. We're still caught in the old system about power, money, and who's on top and all of this stuff. I want my children to survive in a country that I deeply love. And I don't see anybody fighting for this. You know, the concept of being a patriot, I can tell you everything wrong with this country. This country has been horrible to my family. I love this country. And the idea that I get to push out a sophisticated version that is not immediately intellectually insulting, the idea that, you know, I've given up huge amounts of income by quieting my podcast because I knew that these cancellations were coming. And I did not want to give people the excuse to come after me. Our time isn't yet, gentlemen. That's what I'm trying to tell you. For 75 years, something hasn't happened. And that's so long that people can't remember that something is about to happen. We are.
Can you define 75? So do you mean like war? Like, what do you mean by something? Nothing has happened.
In the fall of 1945, we dropped some atomic devices in Japan. And with the exception in some sense of maybe the Great Leap Forward in China, we didn't have 20th century level tumult. So we've been through this incredibly quiescent period. Mm-hmm. And we are the children of the Great Nap. We grew up in a, you know, even with the Cold War, the storm clouds were always on the horizon. The Cuban Missile Crisis, they stayed on the horizon. So as a result, we don't really know what reality is. We've been in a prolonged state of unreality. And when you look at what happened at the Capitol building and you compare it to what happened at Stalingrad, you're not even, these aren't the same parts of speech. Mm-hmm. The future is coming, and it's going to come pretty violently because nobody knows how to hold this thing together. And I don't mean violently necessarily in terms of blood in the streets. It could be the disruption of our legal system. It could be any one of a number of things. But what's happened is we've held the future at bay. This is my wife, Pia Milani's observation. And that COVID accelerated the future because the future has been held back by the people born in the 1940s. The fact that all five of the major candidates left at the end of the election were all born in the 1940s, all of them would be the oldest person ever to take office, tells you something because it was not even remarked upon. Effectively, what you're looking at is the pre-Great Society world attempting to hold back the future. And this is their last, you know, when you corner a beast at the end of its life, it is maximally ferocious because it has no reason to hold back. And what we're seeing is a maximally ferocious group of septa and octogenarians clinging to power, which is about to give way. And what I'm trying to tell both of you is your time isn't quite yet. All that you're doing right now is you're getting yourself set for what comes next. And the key question will be, how do we get rid of Brian Williams? How do we get rid of Mara Gay? How do we get rid of Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump and Joe Biden? And get technically capable, social media savvy people who live in the modern world into the chairs that are needed to direct the institutions. If the institutions only listen to institutional media, what we're doing is whatever Winston Churchill was doing before World War II. Mm-hmm. And what I highly recommend, gentlemen, is look at Chamberlain's speech of resignation. We always talk about Chamberlain waving the paper about peace in our time and go home and get some sleep and all this kind of stuff. That was his low point. You want to know what his high point was? His resignation speech. It'll give you chills. What he did was he said, Hitler, I don't know, had invaded Holland, maybe. I can't remember exactly. And he says, Hitler is counting on our division. And you want to know what he doesn't count on? What I'm about to do next. I'm resigning. I'm resigning to back Winston Churchill. And Winston Churchill has asked me to stay on. So fuck you. Well, Joe Biden, if he was an American patriot, would resign at this moment because he can't give the speech that you just said. Joe Biden cannot give the unity speech. Killer Mike could give the unity speech. I could give the unity speech. You guys could give the unity speech. Joe Biden can do the Neville. Try to imagine not being up to the level of Neville Chamberlain. If Joe Biden resigns, and he should resign, right? Like, this is my thing. People used to do this stuff. People used to understand that the commitment to country was a real thing, and that hanging on to power, like, for what purpose is Joe Biden hanging on to power? He's 78. What's he going to get from this? He can't lead. He's so tarnished. He's so tainted. MAGA's tainted. Everybody who only called balls and strikes for 4 years is tainted, you know? And my claim is that those of us who are untainted have this idea of, oh, we can't sit down in the chair. The fuck, we can't sit down in the chair, gentlemen. We can sit down in those chairs. I mean, what degree from what university does Brian Williams have that makes, is it his hair? He's got better hair in some sense for television than any of us. Okay. Is that the qualification? I mean, let me ask you guys a question. If he was doing a podcast that wasn't institutionally affiliated, what do you think his numbers would be?
Yeah, it would be low. But I mean, the whole point, right, is that he's just been around forever. He's actually a pretty good interviewer whenever it comes to some, you know, news segments. I didn't say he was perfect, but look, this is the thing is.
No, he's not.
I do have to cut in for something, Eric.
Yeah.
I really disagree with what you said about Joe Biden. And mind you, he can disprove all of this. But looking at the Democratic Party of today, looking at the terrible reality of what, and obviously we started this conversation talking about how we should look to history and like this wasn't Stalingrad, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think Joe Biden is basically the only person within the institutional Democratic Party who A, has an actual constituency that really matters, that B, has the capacity to make the unifying decisions that he has to make. He could totally fail to do that. He can make the wrong calls, but the fact that during the height of everything, Joe Biden has the confidence to say, no, I'm not for defunding the police. Or no, I actually know that most Democrats and people in this country don't support Medicare for All. But that matters. That's the judgment. If he resigns, there is no Churchill waiting in the wings. That's the problem here. That's a good point. And the difference is Churchill by that point too was what? He was 65 years old. So it wasn't as if there was these like young whippersnappers who were ready to go. I just don't think the historical analogy works here.
I guess the question is why, when Joe Biden seems to be, at least within the Democratic Party, the only person of even wanting to do what you are alluding to there, Eric, what is to be done? Why should he resign?
I think at everything you're critiquing, Kamala Harris would be worse.
On every single count that we're talking about.
I genuinely believe that Kamala Harris would be worse.
Agreed. I don't want him to resign so that Kamala takes over. Mm-hmm. What I'm trying to say is the entire class is tainted.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. And I was saying also, Marshall, what you were saying is that we haven't created break glass in case of emergency people. Mm-hmm. And I want to be very clear about something. I am not interested in a political career. I would be a disaster. So let me destroy any hope.
No, I'm too honest.
No, it's not just too honest. You know, there's certain... There are executive decisions. I'm a thinker. I'm not the ability to make a strong decision on limited information, commit to it, and lead people is a special skill set. And I'm not embarrassed that that isn't my skill set. I'm freaking terrific at all sorts of things. I'm not terrific at that. I am not running for office. I'm not trying to get power. I'm not trying. This is not part of a grab. You know, there's this old Bill Hicks routine about marketing and sales that once you start thinking in marketing and sales team terms and somebody tells you that they hate marketing and salespeople say, oh, great, you're going after the anti-marketing and sales dollar. That's good dollar. You can't get out of the mindset of everybody's grasping for power. Power is fucking boring. I mean, I want to do math and physics. I want to push out all sorts of amazing things to my audience and delight the world. I want to go play the mandolin. You know, I'm not interested in government. What I am saying is I'm interested in making sure that the break glass in case of emergency people get into a position where they can take over from the corrupt people. And I think that the problem, to be honest, is that you guys have Stockholm syndrome from living in DC. I mean, what we need currently is, and I understand what you're saying about Biden and he threads some line, but you know, he voted for the 2005 bill to make student debt non-dischargeable in bankruptcy. I can go through a million things that Joe Biden has done badly. You know, to tell people that he's going to prioritize everybody who doesn't look like him for help with their business. Well, Lord knows what Hunter Biden sells, you know, to make his millions. Enough. And I think that part of the problem is that we're used to selecting from a pull-down menu. I would recommend that all of your listeners go to a Starbucks and ask for a short coffee, because you'll notice it's not on the menu. And when you ask for the short coffee, they will give you the short coffee. There are things that are not on the menu that you have to know to ask for. And so right now, the point is, I don't want to pull down Kamala Harris or Joe Biden or Elizabeth Warren or any one of these people. I want the short coffee. Give me the short coffee. I don't want Mara Gay. I don't want Nicole Hannah-Jones. I don't want Sean Hannity, none of these people. And the problem is that most of us have the idea, well, if not A, then the other thing, then B. My point is, no, I want 37, Q, and you're just talking about A-B testing.
So here's a question that builds into everything you're saying here. What, because despite our DC Stockholm syndrome, which is definitely a real thing in many respects, we do largely agree with your critique. We, frankly, don't want to run for office either.
Great.
That's the dynamic here. But that being said, there are people who do want to run for office. There are young people who show up in DC. I'm not going to name names here, but who build very big social media followings and then come into office. Like, I will name a name here, like Madison Cawthorn, you know, who has been a frustrating experience from my perspective, because on the one hand, he starts out and he talks about how he wants to fix healthcare and be his generation's leader, X, Y, and Z thing. And then on the day of his election, he's tweeting and he's apologized for this, name you, but, you know, owned lib or just whatever. He's falling back into the trap of that previous system. So what would your advice be for young people who are trying to not be, who want to be that break glass figure, but every single incentive is to push them in the opposite direction? Everything is telling you to go speak at the DSA convention or to go speak at the Turning Point USA conference.
Well, first of all, if you speak at Turning Point USA, I don't think there's anything wrong with speaking at Turning Point USA. Just make sure that Charlie Kirk knows that you're going to say something that isn't so charitable about Turning Point USA and that you're going to thank him for the opportunity the same way I do it on Fox News. So The first thing is that you can absolutely go on Fox News and tell them that Fox News is a propaganda network. And once you've done that, that's fine. If you listen, I went on Ted Cruz's podcast, The Verdict. But you got to be disagreeable. You can't get swept up in the desire to make nice. You can't sell your hosts out. I'm not going to, you know, go on Ted Cruz's podcast to stick it to Ted Cruz. I really appreciate the fact, and I was polite as could be. On the other hand, I'm no pushover, and don't be a pushover. Have your own independent sense of reality and make sure that you carry it with you when you get onto that stage, and make sure that you try to call balls and strikes and be prepared that you're going to be called, you know. The amazing thing in the internet era is that there's a name for every ready-made argument. You know, oh, both sidesism. Oh, that's just whataboutism. Okay, well, you're going to get the automated bot-level arguments. Dude, I thought you had integrity. Now I realize you're just a grifter. Right. Like, blah, blah, blah. You know, these are the hyenas of social media, and they just nip at you to try to wear you down. Okay, what you need, you know, you ever watch hyenas going after a lion? You got 20 hyenas on one lion until the rest of the family shows up. And that's one of the reasons why I'm doing the show. You guys are break glass in case of emergency people. You know, Joe Rogan, Ben Shapiro. Ben Shapiro and I can appear together. If you want to see unity, Glenn Beck just reached out to me, said, you know, we need unity now. And I was never a Glenn Beck fan, but I just wrote one letter. You know, I think I just wrote one word in. You know, what do you need? Let's do this thing. So my claim is lead by example, and you don't have to be perfect. You know, I lashed out at Kyle Kachuv. You know, when he was like saying, "I tried to warn you about this. Enjoy, you know, your new Biden administration." And I deleted the tweets, you know, because I was on edge. You don't have to be Jesus Christ or some kind of a saint. You don't have to be Mother Teresa. The key thing is people eventually get that you really care and that you're decent and that, you know, maybe you want power or fame. You want to be thought well of. I know that I want status, blah, blah, blah. It's not a big sin. What we've got to do is recognize our time isn't yet, and we're on the doorstep of our time, and we have to get there. And so what I would say to those young people is don't screw up your future playing in the present while the present is unraveling. Better to forego it, take a few years. You're not going to get there necessarily. Maybe this whole thing blows up before you ever get there, in which case, I'm sorry. But your best bet is not to play in the present. The thing to do is to get the damn septuagenarians and octogenarians who do not come from the modern era, who come from the pre-Great Society universe, off the stage, replace them with technically capable people who are better adapted to the modern era. And you can find these people by the people who are maximally demonized relative to their reality, because those, let the system tell you who it fears most. Go scan the list of alt-right people. Every person called a Nazi with a Jewish surname should be somebody that you're probably interested in talking to. Every person who's never voted Republican who's called the far right is somebody you should be interested in talking to. Everyone with an advanced degree in virology who says the Wuhan lab hypothesis should not be off the table because we don't do science by putting our politics first before we examine all of the evidence. All of those people, I mean, it's very hard when you can't trust the CDC, the Surgeon General, Anthony Fauci, or the WHO to know what you're doing locked at home while your business is crumbling. Not sure whether, in fact, this is actually a very serious pandemic or a bad version of the flu, because I can tell you, I can't figure it out. I'm a pretty smart guy. I can't figure it out. There are times when I hear that the hospital beds are overflowing and we don't have space in the ICU and we have triage desks. And there are other reports I hear that we've got all of these beds ready and that nobody's inhabiting them. None of this makes any sense. So my claim is that if you feel like you can't figure out COVID, you can't figure out what just happened in the election, you don't understand why the election is disputed in this way, join the club. I don't know how much voter fraud there was in this election. What I do know is that our courts didn't find any of this persuasive. And so if you're going to claim, well, okay, no, the courts are actually under Russian control, if you keep adding epicycles to your conspiracy theory, where the Donald Trump appointed justices aren't affirming Donald Trump, there's some point at which you got to realize that you've been engaged in a massive LARP. Then the LARP is based on a certain amount of reality. And right now, what we need to do is to have a place to come back. And I just want to talk about this one woman in Texas. I saw on social media, she adores me. She says, you know, you're my favorite person, blah, blah, blah. And it's very touching. And I see her wrapped in a Trump cape, you know, and she's at this January 6th rally. And I knew to fear the January 6th rally. And 2 days before it, I put out a tweet stream trying.
You did. Yeah.
I called her up and she's like, I can't believe you're calling me. And I just said, look, you're in college and you're going to something like a rave and you're having great conversations and you're having fun and you're trying to explain your patriotism and you're worried that you saw all of the thumb on the scales from media and you're worried that it extends to the election. And the person who got shot could have been you. And she immediately talked to me about, you know, well, how do I go towards Biden? It's like, no, neither. Get off that spectrum. Go to your studies. Go get drunk. You know, and I said, be young, wild, and free. That's your job right now. Get away from these old people. These are crazy old people, and they have no future. This is all going to be taken care of by Father Time. In 20 years, Bill Clinton is in all likelihood going to be dead. Hillary Clinton. Very few of these people are going to be around. You are still going to be here. Stop investing in these old people. They've gotten control of our society. In any previous era, before the 1980s, before we started messing around with mandatory retirement, which was allowing our society to renew itself, these people would be embarrassed to be seeking office. You know, I mean, when was the last time an octogenarian showed up for a Sports Illustrated swimsuit photo shoot? At some level, it's not appropriate. You know, it's just, I appreciate that they want to stay engaged. But, you know, there's a reason that Jimmy Carter and Walter Mondale didn't run in 2020. And it's because they have better sense to realize it's not their time anymore. And I probably would rather have had Jimmy Carter than Joe Biden.
That's when you know things are really bleak. Eric, I want to end it there because I think that's such an inspiring and important point. And I can say, too, from personal experience, that you're 100% right. I mean, just a small story, but, you know, whenever I was choosing between Rising, which, remember, at that time, there was no Rising.
I know.
It was like, it was just Crystal, right? There was this show at The Hill, which was, you know, had 6,000 subscribers on YouTube. It was like literally nothing, not something people knew anything about. And I had another job offer as a White House correspondent with a larger news organization here in DC. And everybody in DC told me to take that White House correspondent job. Every single one.
I remember this. People talked a lot of shit. It was a real thing. What's Sagar doing is a whole thing.
What's he doing? They were like, take the DC correspondent job. They're like, who knows about this thing? Stay within your path. Keep doing these 3-minute Fox News appearances, right? Over and over again. Like, that's the cachet, Sagar. Don't you understand? Like, what are you doing? And I self-exited from the system before I got to it. I hit the red button. And I was like, no, enough. I don't care enough about Fox. I don't care about being at the White House all the time. I don't care about doing these Trump interviews. I don't care about all of the traditional things in Washington media that we care about and that we are supposed to care about in terms of your career. What happens? A year later, holy shit, you're on the Joe Rogan podcast, right? It was like me colliding with a world that they knew tangentially but didn't value. And they didn't understand, you know, the success of the program or the growth, and they minimized it, you know, basically until they couldn't reckon with the fact about how big it had gotten and my ability to have you here to talk to you. I mean, I know people were like, I listen to Eric Weinstein to figure out what's going on. And I'm like, oh yeah, you know, I've talked with Eric, he's been on my podcast. They're like, oh my God, you actually know him? And it's just this self-defeating problem that we have here in Washington and all establishment media in particular, where they're always going to tell you to take the safe route, and the only way to succeed, and this happens with politics, anybody who is young, is you have to self-exit and say, it's like you said, you have to look to where the future is going and you have to play that game instead of doing what some like boomer executives want you to do and play within the role that you're assigned yourself. So I just want to say again, like, thank you for underscoring that. And really, in a time like this, we had to talk to you because you are one of the few people here who, in good faith, is trying to reach. We want to live in a more harmonious country. And I genuinely know that whenever I talk to you. I don't know that whenever I talk to a lot of people, left, right. I mean, all of it is about punishment. All of it is about exacting a cost from your enemies. I don't know many people who would say about MAGA, people like, these are my brothers and sisters. We have to talk that way more again.
I know we just said we're going to finish up, but I just thought of a question that came up here. This is totally random. Apologies for that. But as we're thinking about punishment and cults, right? The use of cult was applied to Trump. I don't know what you think about this, though, Sagar. Mm-hmm. Within Eric's framework of what would you do if your kids were kidnapped by a cult? You go the fuck in, you do all that stuff, but you almost certainly would support the punishment of the cult leader, especially if that punishment would prevent him from doing that to other people's kids. So how do you think about the punishment framework within the contract you've created for Eric? Because it's unclear which direction it goes.
I agree with that. I would say, and this is what I said on my show this morning, which is that he lost the election. That's the punishment. Like, he lost. That's the real price. He was humiliated on a national stage and lost states that he won previously. Eric, I'm curious, before we go, what do you think about that?
I have a very, people will not understand this. I'm hesitant to say it, but I think I probably should. Mm-hmm. I believe in smacking some people to the curb and being the first to make sure that you offer them a hand back up. And my feeling is that right now, Donald Trump needs to be smacked to the goddamn curb. And I also believe that at some level, you need to potentially offer, if not him, certainly people around him, a hand back up and a way back. And the vengeance, the problem with social justice theory is that justice is actually sometimes a euphemism for vengeance. Mm-hmm. A lot of us feel very humiliated. We feel very jealous. And Donald Trump is going to be built back up by overreach of the Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party is not without its own blood on its hands. And in essence, the Democratic Party created the presidency of Donald Trump, in my opinion, by saying, oh, how do we get somebody to irradiate themselves? Well, we'll give them cancer and then they'll need to irradiate themselves. inside of that framework, I don't think that the Democratic Party is in a position to do this. I do think that the tiny group of misfits to which you guys belong, and I can't tell you how touched I am that you guys think in these terms. Let me just say that for all future appearances on anything you do, you have a general yes. I don't give out a general yes, but I so admire what you guys are doing that just don't even ask me to come next time whenever you want. What I'm really thinking is that at some level, you do need to smack some people to the curb, but you also need to recognize that religions that are around for thousands of years have forgiveness and grace and redemption. And this passion for the destruction of the individual, the cancellation of an entire human being, and the social isolation from deplatforming is a recipe for creating people with nothing left to lose who have access to fertilizer and potassium nitrate and worse. And, you know, my claim is that most of us need love and admiration and trust. And look at my timeline. The number of people who say, Eric, I always politically disagree with you, but I never feel that you're condescending. Never use words like knuckle draggers or make fun of the inability of people to spell. I talk a lot about the fact that my IQ is a bit lower than most people imagine because of my learning issues. I talk about the fact that I'm disgusted with the tote bag conspiracy. You know, if you have Carl Castle on your answering machine, that you're so proud of the fact that you're not like those other people in the center of the country, who, by the way, all those farmers actually know genetics probably better than you do, because you just don't even understand what's going on in Kansas or Montana or whatever, ranchers. We need to basically realize that the rest of our country is being driven insane by its media, but that person to person, human to human, most of us are better. And one of the things that I really think, you know, the cure for anti-Semitism is getting to know more Jews as friends. The cure for anti-Black prejudice is, you know, hanging out in Black spaces and experiencing the warmth and hospitality. Part of the problem is that we've learned to distrust each other and to look down on each other. And if you will just come forward with an open heart and an outstretched hand, almost everybody immediately realizes that they're coked up on institutional media. And once that kind of haze and fog lifts, we get back to the business of being who we are. Because frankly, if we're going to be, we're great and the other side is horrible, that's not America. You've already given up on your country. And so I just want to say what a pleasure it is to be in a position where whatever our differences are, I know you guys have your hearts in the right place. And I just view myself as a supporting actor. You guys are the future, and anything I can do to help you get you there would be my honor.
Well, thanks, likewise, Eric. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. Be sure to subscribe to the Realignment Substack. It is in the link in your show notes. Be sure to send us a 5-star rating with your questions, either on Apple Podcasts or to realignmentpod@gmo.com. And lastly, and most importantly, be sure to check out our bookshop.org site. We love when you guys check out the books that you're looking at.
As always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast, and we will see you all on Thursday.